So the question is about how the police would determine to go to certain locations.
Like this place here.
Right.
Like
so
right
now. So hypothetically, if someone was in the police department, what would they have considered to come here? And from everything that has come up in the trial, it looks like it would just be on the basis that they had some sort of research or intelligence, to use a word that they would probably use, that would indicate that this was a place the anarchists came to on a regular basis. And it could be founded or unfounded. It could be weak, and at the same time, they would still deploy their surveillance team officers to come here because they had the money and they had the resources and they wanted to do everything at all costs. The thing I didn't mention related to the surveillance operation was not only were they looking for these people who would talk about criminal activity, and I'll pause for a moment, I'll interrupt where I was going, and say that the talk about criminal activity is not a crime, and you could easily eavesdrop on people and hear them talking about criminal activity, and they wouldn't be planning anything at all, and they wouldn't be doing, and you would take it out of context, and then you turn it around on those individuals. But the officers were out there because they were concerned about where the resources were going to be deployed for the NATO meeting. How many officers, personnel, did we need to have out on the street to do crowd control for the protest? And the way that they went about making that determination was spying on people like those who are out in this audience and others in the Chicago community. Right, so the question is, how are the prosecutors using anarchists, that label, to essentially assassinate the character of these defendants and to convince the jury that they are, in fact, guilty of committing alleged crimes? And so far, we haven't had the defense. So far, the prosecutors are going about this in a way of conflating anarchism and Black Bloc immediately with committing acts of violence and playing off that prejudice that is part of society, just, you know, the normal American society, this misunderstanding of what anarchism is about. And there has been nothing in the trial about the anarchism in a sense of, like, politically, what does that actually mean? That has been ignored entirely. And there has not been any evidence brought forward, whether through talking about Facebook messages or text messages or things that were said on recordings, about what, in fact, does that mean. And when the two undercover officers, Mo or Nadia, are asked about what Black Bloc is, they do give this explanation that it varies. Actually, Mo's was more favorable to the defendants in the sense that he just said that Black Bloc was about concealing your identity, which I think is a more correct assessment of it. But I'm not personally one to stand up here and wax as an expert on Black Bloc, and I'll refrain from doing that, but just to say that in this trial, what they are doing is suggesting automatically that if you are a Black Bloc person or if you are an anarchist, you would immediately be someone who would commit these acts of violence. And to the mentioning of the man who had the tattoo and was approached by Nadia, he did write this really great thing, and I have it right here in front of me, and I'll just read what he was talking about is this encounter, and then he put it in these terms of how the police would never understand what he was about what he was trying to do and why he was there at that event, and he actually said, "What is the threat Chico and the CPD see in the anarchists? Is it just the word that draws attention to them? Or is it this fear of militia groups that they've cultivated after watching Fight Club too many times in their man caves? Is the government soon going to put the black bags over our heads, throw us in a cell, and tell us they will only let us out when we name names? If we are to name names, we can only name ourselves because humans are sovereign beings. We may work together, but in the end, we stand alone. If we are to follow textbook anarchism, the names we would come up with would include any cop who ever bent a rule or walked outside the lines of protocol to help someone out. Any police officer that ever caught a 13-year-old kid with a bag of weed and made the decision to give him a ride home and maybe lend an ear has a little bit that threatened them. Any teacher who lent a student a copy of Persepolis after the schools took it out of their libraries is just as guilty of anti-state thinking as someone who made vague threats over the internet and currently stands trial. And he goes on, and he talks about his history, and he says, also, the Chicago Police Department lists among their core values integrity, leadership, and courage. What is it they think we are doing by booking our own shows? Having honest exchanges with people across class, color, and gender lines, and trying to remove ourselves in small ways from a system we see as corrupt. In a post-9/11 landscape where everyone is afraid of each other, we are the people opening up positive communication and trying to support involvement and creativity from people that are otherwise marginalized. If CPD expects us to stand trial for that, then I waive my right to attorney and choose to speak to the jury as my peers. Actually, I should figure out a way if I can republish it. I'm not quite sure. It's not entirely accessible. So the question is, where can you find the thing that was written about the person who wrote about being approached by Nadia and his experience? And it's up on a location right now on a site called Reddit, and it's not easily accessible, I think, for the general public. So it would be good to pull it out and repost it somewhere, although I'm not quite sure if I can just copy it and paste it some other location. I probably need to get permission or some kind of something like that. So the question is he a Chicagoan? And I don't know. He was here. He was at a concert event and was approached by an undercover officer. I do not know if he's a person who lives here in Chicago. But this posting was online in a part of this social media website that is just for Chicago postings. So it's possible that he is a Chicago resident. So the question is, what's the physical evidence in the case? I'll break it up into two categories because there's physical evidence that relates to the act that the two undercover officers managed to get the men to engage in, but there's other physical evidence that they've inserted into the trial to sensationalize the whole proceedings and convince the jury that these are bad people. And so there's the beer bottles, these four beer bottles that they put gasoline in. However, we don't know how much gasoline because they dumped the gas down the toilet instead of taking it back to the police station to analyze and measure out. And even though the material was biohazard, they marked it with a green biohazard sticker, they still dumped it down the toilet into our sewage system. And then the materials were taken back. They have cloths. They put cloths in the bottles. So they took pictures of these, the four bottles. They had bandana cloths that were sticking out of them. And the gas came by from a nearby BP gas station. And so they have this evidence as what they basically, these are the weapons of mass destruction. And then they have these other weapons that were legally possessed, which Brian Jacob Church owned, and which he did not leave in Florida because he had no good place to leave them. And he keeps them in a guitar case, and he brought them up in his car, and these have been brought out at least two or three times in the course of the trial in order to, these were never used. And they bring these out, and they're two knives. One is a sword. They've got a bow and arrow with some arrows, and then there's a throwing star. And they put these all out in front of the jury. And the prosecutor gave this weird description of the knife too. It's a man-made knife with a sharp edge. Yeah. And the jury hears all of this, and of course this is all of like making them believe that these are men that would have done this to the police into the city. So the question is about the shield. There is a shield that could only be carried by one to four people, depending on which prosecutor is carrying it into the room on that day. And that's just a part of the case because they apparently claimed they were going to use the shield and they were going to push it, and all three of them were going to take the shield. The shield has screws in this. I shouldn't be using the word shield. It's a big sign made out of plywood or recycled wood, and the saying on it is austerity ain't going to happen. The A is a typical anarchist symbol, and the big sign is this thing that had rope handles into it, and they put screws to keep the rope handles in place. And I don't know how the handles were going to work exactly, but this was how the three, one of the men at least, conceived this sign. And this, they say, the screws inside of the sign were deliberately put in the way that they were, because they were going to use the screws that were sticking out of the sign in order to injure people at the demonstration, probably particularly police. And when asked to describe the screws, defense attorney Thomas Durkin, who's one of the attorneys representing Jared Chase, he had this officer get down from the stand. This is the officer that seized the sign and said, how far out of this board do you think this screw is sticking out? And he looked, and they decided about 3/4 of an inch. And then Durkin asked, well, why wouldn't they have just maybe let them stick out much farther? You know, if they really wanted to do damage to the police, why wouldn't it have been maybe 2 inches, 3 inches maybe, because they really wanted to drive this in? And the officer said, oh, well, it's because basically they would have been noticed if they came to the protest, and then they probably would have been stopped. And so it's basically like camouflage. They kept it shorter, and they painted over it red because they wanted to hide that they had these screws that they were going to do damage. So this is where I say, you know, this is further evidence of the fabrication of the case. This is all being made out of thin air in the room. I can talk about the GPS device that was attached to their car and how we had this police officer who had analyzed the data take the stand, and the defense invited him to give his theory on what would have been happening in downtown with this car when it had the GPS device. Because he said, I look at this data downtown and I think that these men were not just tourists, and they weren't just people who were lost in the city. They were driving around and they were scouting for terrorist targets. This is what he said. And why do I know that? Because there are banks downtown. And here is where the Federal Reserve Branch is located. Here's where the Chicago Board of Trade is located. And also, not too far, is the Obama campaign headquarters. So he gives his theory about this. And then when he finishes, the defense now can ask questions and asks him, was it possible that these men couldn't find parking in downtown Chicago? Maybe they needed a place to put their car. Yeah. And the officer is very certain that this was not the case. He said, no, that's not possible. He said, well, did you know that Occupy Chicago was right there on Jackson and LaSalle? And this is right around where these young men were driving. He said, oh, yeah, I guess I did know. And he asked him, did you know that they were part of Occupy? And this is the semantics that the prosecutors have been playing and sort of trying. It's interesting how the prosecutors think that it's probably acceptable to the jury that you would have been part of Occupy Chicago. So what they're doing in the trial is saying, no, they weren't really part of Occupy Chicago. They just came to Occupy Chicago events. So one of the other things that the police think they get to decide who is a member of these groups. And so they say, we know they were at Occupy encampments at like Occupy Boston, or we know they were at Occupy Richmond, North Carolina. We know they went to Occupy encampments, but we don't necessarily agree that they were part of these groups.
We know when it was attacked?
Yeah, we do. I want to say that it's after the, I don't have the exact date off the top of my head, but it's after May 4th when they got the court order for the wired devices. Somewhere about like May 6th or 7th, they go and they attached the device to the men drove up in a Ford Taurus and they put the device on it. The question is, how can the prosecutors or police decide whether these young men are part of the Occupy groups, right? So how does it make sense that if the men were going to Occupy encampments that they weren't part of Occupy? The answer is, obviously I don't think it makes sense personally. But what I can tell you, the reason why they're doing that is it fits in with everything that I have presented, which is that these are put, quote, anarchists, or quote, black bloc people who were going to be there to cause violence. And their theory on the activist community, as Nadia articulated, is that these people are violent anarchists, quote, violent anarchists, that wanted to infiltrate peaceful protest communities. They happen to think Occupy Chicago is peaceful, or at least they've conceded that it's peaceful, whether they think that's true or not. For the purposes of this case, in order to put these men that they think are, or that they want us to believe are dangerous behind bars, they've decided to do a separation, the sort of like called classic divide and conquer, to say the Occupy Chicago people are acceptable activists, but these men who were talking about doing dangerous things, they're not acceptable activists, and they are not of this group. And that's a strategy to convince the jury that they are, that the three, NATO three, the young men, are people who should go to jail. This gets to a much larger issue of, in this country, what happens when we have these sort of events and we host them, like the Republican National Convention or the Democratic National Convention or a trade meeting or the NATO meeting. And the government now designates these things as national special security events. And then automatically that means that they can do all sorts of things that they wouldn't typically be allowed to do, including passing laws that I know activists called the sit down or shut up laws for regulating how people could go out and organize and even what signs you were going to have at the demonstration, of putting more surveillance cameras up on the streets for monitoring people. And then under this national special security event, they sent out people to do the wide police surveillance operation. And essentially, they have a general order, like a police directive, a general order, for doing what they were doing, which they happened to call a First Amendment-related investigation. And that means that they're actually targeting First Amendment activities, but they've gained, they're supposed to go through some kind of a procedure to get authorization to send officers to these meetings. Someone told me this is a relic of the consent decree that came out of the suits around the Red Squad issue in Chicago. And so they send these people out, and it's all under taking advantage of this, and we don't know what sort of orders they were given. What we do know is that Nadia was not trained as an undercover before she went out into the field. She had zero training on what an undercover officer was supposed to do. They plucked her cold from whatever she was doing prior to February 2012, put her into the police intelligence unit, and sent her out. I think that Mo had more experience, but at this moment I'm not very clear on what exactly he had been doing. And I think he's actually even in a better position because now she can't even be an undercover officer because her image and likeness is all over. And I think Mo is probably going to be okay, and you might find him in another seedy operation because he went around with activists. He had a beard on his face, and now he shaved the beard off, and he looks like a completely different individual. So he might be okay. But in any case, it is not clear what orders these people were given and how they were advised on what conduct they would engage in when they were with these. But what I can tell you is in the directive, there are levels that you have for what you are authorized to do. She was a level 2 and was allowed to go out and collect all of this intelligence and attend these meetings and be in the apartment with these activists. A level 3 is actually infiltrating the group, is actually becoming a part of the group, which is what they did. So what I'm saying is that the evidence that the defense has presented suggests that they exceeded what they were authorized to do by the Chicago Police Department. Because if you talk to any of those activists in Occupy Chicago or connected movements, they will tell you that Mo and Nadia were acting as if they were part of the groups. Anything that's part of the criminal investigation is essentially, for the most part, if it's specific to going after these guys, the three young men, that is fair game for them to ask people about when these witnesses are on the stand.
People in Chicago, from Occupy or whatever, in that community of resistance, had encountered the two police officers.
No? Yeah, so the question is, were there black bloc masks, or were there black masks, just black masks, period, that were found by police? And then the other question is, did others know not to go near these two officers, and yet the three young men being out-of-towners, they had no idea, and maybe that was why they ended up being swept up in this operation. I've seen no evidence of black bandana masks or anything put. They've shown pictures of them being at marches. They were wearing masks on their face.
They did
do what I guess you call block up, which is to conceal your identity. And then the question of, you know, have I seen evidence presented about how people were already suspicious of these two, the Nadia and Mo officers, that has not been part of the trial. And I do not know from personally talking to other activists that were involved in socializing with them, whether they ever suspected. In fact, I think it's the opposite. I think that I've been told that they were hugging Mo and Nadia, and they were hanging out with each other in their cars, and they very much believed that both of these officers were committed to activism in the same way that they are committed to organizing. And so it's been very difficult for them to sit in that courtroom and hear the things that are coming out because they lived those moments, and now they're reliving the anxiety and anguish they had from learning that these people were officers and were, you know, eavesdropping and taking advantage of them in those weeks before the NATO meeting. Yeah, so the larger issue is, what does this say about police and what they're doing to control dissent, to even squelch it entirely so that it's not an issue for the powers that be? And I would add that the larger nationwide context that you see this trial playing out in is that out in the Northwest, you have people who do actually call themselves anarchists being brought before grand juries and made to answer questions or else go to prison and even be in solitary confinement for not cooperating with the authorities. And the FBI sent the Joint Terrorism Task Force to their homes because they believed they were involved in some May Day rally damage and needed to be prosecuted, but they don't have any evidence of a crime, so they go on a fishing expedition and turn their lives inside out. Here in Chicago, we have the more than 20 activists in the Midwest that we still have this grand jury investigation into them by the U.S. government from the Justice Department. And also recently, I wrote about this, you talk about just getting in there and intimidating and trying to scare people who have turned to activism. In Oklahoma, they had this this is just an accident. They didn't even plan to do this. They went into Devon Energy Tower, some people who were protesting against the dirty energy, the natural gas or fracking of this Devon Energy Corporation. And they went into this building And they went on the balcony and they unfurled a banner. And glitter just dropped down from the banner. And it fell off and it landed on the ground and it's entirely innocent. And the janitor came over and cleaned it up. But then you find out, and this company has a tie to TransCanada, which is the corporation that's building the Keystone XL pipeline, which looks like Barack Obama is going to go ahead with and authorize. And the protesters thought that everything was okay, and then they start to hear, the lawyer for the protesters heard that the police were talking to someone, and they're going to find a part of the anti-terrorism law that the Oklahoma state has, and they're going to see if they can get these activists on something for what they had just done in this tower against Devon Energy. And the glitter's on the ground, and now they bring in the people in the hazmat suits, and they're looking at it for biohazard. They say it's now a biohazard, and they take it back, and they arrest these guys and say that they're looking into charging them on terrorism hoax for the fact that glitter dropped off a banner accidentally because they didn't make the banner correctly or whatever. And so this is exactly what you're saying of these people haven't been charged yet. I don't know what they're going to do. But you keep that cloud over them of, you know, we don't know what's going to happen to us. The state's looking into us. They might prosecute us for terrorism. That's actually, in some ways, worse than actually being charged because you don't know what's going to happen to you. The question is, does the jury have any sort of reasonable understanding of what NATO happens to be as an organization and what the city was planning in terms of security? Do they understand why the Chicagoans, activists all over the country, wanted to come to Chicago to protest this meeting? I think that we haven't really gotten into that, but what I can give you is the officer, Nadia, gave her understanding of what NATO happens to be. I can read that to you right here because I have it in this transcript. Now, the one thing I'll say that's really fascinating about this case is that these officers, they go online and they do searches on Google and they say they found stuff and it's not clear where they actually ended up. And you do realize that Google is not just a website. And then there are things, they're on like different locations. And you have to say, did you find it on CNN? Or did you find it on, rahrahpolice.com? Or like, where did you go? So Deutsch asked her, what were you searching for on Google? She said, to be honest, when I was first told about the assignment, I didn't even know what NATO really was or what was coming to Chicago. So I had to look it up to figure it out. And then Deutsch said, that's what you searched on Google, what NATO was? And she said, correct. When it was coming, what dates it would be here, what protests and rallies were like, just what people looked like, what people wore. I didn't know what it was, sir, so I honestly wasn't looking it up to see what it was to get acquainted. So I honestly was looking it up to see what it was to get acquainted with it. And Deutsch said, what did you find out about what the people look like? And she said, just normal people. I didn't know what it was, sir. I just looked it up. He's very defensive. What did you learn from your Google search? That's what I am asking you, he said. And Nadia replied, I learned that NATO stood for the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, as one would. I learned that heads of states came together and they discussed global issues. I learned that people protested and rallied it, that people came in from all over to attend these protests and rallies, that it was actually a big deal to a lot of people. Things of that nature, sir. So it's a very fluffy, weak, thin sort of explanation of what it is. But that's so far what the jury probably understands about what was happening. It's just a meeting, global issues. You know, no sense of what NATO does in Afghanistan when civilians are being killed in airstrikes because they're called in to clean up after a night raid by the coalition forces that are in there committing violence. And no sense that they're involved in cover-ups when the communities in, or villages in Afghanistan are upset about the number of civilians, and they want the truth out about the extent of the death toll, and the NATO fudges the numbers and puts out a really low civilian casualty count in order to play their PR game. So they have no idea what these people were particularly talking about and how it was a meeting about extending the Afghanistan war. The larger question, and just in case people who are going to hear this weren't able to understand, Rob just articulated the fact that there is an activist here in Chicago named Henry Edwards. His name keeps coming up in the trial. It's been very easy to make this leap, if you are not careful and cautious, that he is working or did work for the police department in some way or got into this sort of capacity where he was acting as an informant, and that did not happen, and that is not who this individual is, and there's been no evidence presented in this trial that he was doing anything of the sort. So the concern is in the activist community that people not look at him negatively because there's no evidence that he did anything wrong to anybody else. And he's not that kind of a person. So then the larger question is, what happens after there's this evidence of police infiltration, and what do people do in the aftermath, and what's the cost to the community? Well, immediately, I'll be very general, just out of respect for the people, but having talked to people who were in that apartment where those three young men were, I think it really calls everything you were doing into question. You yourself feel insecure, and you go back over those moments when you were with those officers constantly. And I don't know if it rises to the level of some sort of like post-traumatic stress disorder type of a thing, but you definitely are sitting there wondering, what if I had done this differently? What if I had walked over to those young men? They weren't, those activists in Occupy Chicago didn't exactly welcome those three young men into the fabric entirely. They were off on their own a lot. And so the reflection that I've heard is, what if we had been more cautious? What if we had covered our bases and made sure that they had better housing? Or there were 15 people staying in this apartment in Bridgeport where it was raided, somewhere between 12 and 15. But what if we had broken people up? And what if we had taken care of out-of-towners a little bit better? Would that have made it more difficult for the police to infiltrate? What if we had cautioned people? What if we had been more explicit about the possibility that police would target you? Because we have a track record in history going back to different events like this, whether it be the Republican National Convention in 2008 or other previous meetings. And so I think that that's the key. And then it also has a way of creating conflicts between activists, of opening sores and wounds among people who maybe aren't going to work together after that, because they now develop their own views about these young men, and then they have different ideas about who they are, and it can get in the way of future organizing efforts here in the city of Chicago, which, and I think that that's something that that these people are going to be grappling with. And depending on the outcome of the trial, I think that'll probably be one of the biggest indicators of where the issues will go. So if they are found not guilty, that's obviously the best case scenario. And I think that people are able to rebuild and pick up the pieces and start to. But if they are all found guilty, and let's say the worst case scenario, they're found guilty of the terrorism charges, I think that just makes it even more stressful for the people involved in trying to figure out what they're going to do, making them feel even more helpless. I think the problem is, and you can connect this to all cases, the problem is these, you could take the Enbridge protesters, the people who protested the pipeline, or anybody else who commits acts and then go to trial, whether they're infiltrated and targeted or they get taken to court on trumped-up offenses. The fact is that this saps a lot of resources doing defense for these people. It takes distracts from focused efforts to go after the issues, to tackle the wars, to stop torture, to stop the drones, to stop fracking, whatever you're stopping. It takes your mind off of that because now you have to focus on the people who have been targets of the state. And so that's, I think, the prime difficulty is finding a way that you can actually continue to organize those issues and at the same time provide a good defense for these people. And I think that's the struggle for the activists who are in the immediate social network of these three young men who did know them in some way, of saying, what do we do now? Where do we move with this? Because I don't think that they've figured out how to keep organizing in Chicago and then at the same time take care of these three young men who they're very just upset that this is what they're going through, that they have lost a year and a half of their lives being in jail, and that even the two of the men, without getting in specifics, even if they are found not guilty, they still will have outstanding criminal issues that they'll have to go resolve back in Florida. So it's not a good situation for at least two of the three. So there are a couple answers I'll give to that, which is I have a reputation for covering national issues. So a lot of people who read my work, I think it's been interesting for them to probably see me focus in on a trial that is local to Chicago. But at the same time, I've been able to pull a lot of people in. In fact, I can actually say that I have some people in like Australia that are interested in what's going on because, you know, undercover police is not a unique thing to any place in the world. You know, they have their share of issues in other countries. And so I think that I've covered this and I've been clear that there's different aspects to it that make me feel that it has national significance and that it's not just about what were these three people doing in Chicago, but that it's, hey, this is how the police operate. This is how law enforcement, this is the culture of law enforcement. And so at the courtroom, we've had regular reporters from WBEZ, Chicago Tribune, and the Sun-Times have had their courts reporter. And on the first day, there were a couple more. There's like the WTTW person was there, and I think there were a few other reporters. I'm actually technically the only national news reporter that's in the room, except for maybe another guy who has been there off and on, but he runs an independent alternative outlet. And we together have been tweeting and sending things out, and those have been good. We tag it with, anybody can find all of the things we've sent out from the courtroom by going to the hashtag NATO3, and then you'll pull up a full history of, well, you'll pull up a history with a lot of what was sent out from the courtroom, and there may be some other things mixed in from people who are just talking and some of the sharing of news articles related, but you'll get some flavor of what's been happening inside of the courtroom. And as a person who's been going there, it's been an interesting experience for me because I do come from this background of covering a military trial with Chelsea Manning, and I had spent a long time doing that, and then I'm now at this courthouse. And in some ways, I have to say that, and this is going to sound absurd to a lot of you, but in some ways, I've had this feeling that I kind of wish the military was prosecuting these three men, just because I've had it easier when I was there getting in and doing what I wanted to do. And I've gone through my share of harassment at the courthouse because I'm not an NBC News reporter. And all the guards in that courthouse look at you with suspicion if you aren't a corporate press person, even though you have credentials. Like, I have my thing on me, and at the same time, I'm constantly being asked questions about what I'm doing and being told about rules that they're making up on the fly that aren't even true. So that's that. That's the scene, and I have found that very interesting to the trial proceedings, because if you are public, you do have to go through background checks, and that's been an incredible wrinkle to this trial proceeding. But I also find it interesting that you do call the people in the public who are coming into the gallery spectators, which would translate that what's happening in the trial is a spectacle, which would mean that this isn't exactly a serious thing that's going on, but the men do face a serious amount of time in prison, so it can't all be amusing, even though I think that for some people in the gallery, they've been gratified to see the defense attorney tear into and question these undercover officers. So the question is, what about these conspiracy charges that they face? And I said that if you are talking about criminal activity, that's not in itself a crime, but yet this sort of talk could be evidence that they were planning a conspiracy. And my answer is that conspiracy charges are, in my opinion, structurally built on prejudices that are within the judicial system. Conspiracy is not an actual act. It's the planning of the act. And where can you sell the idea that someone was planning to commit a conspiracy? Well, you can easily do it if there are people in this country who are marginalized easily. And so it's my sense that these conspiracy charges are, the way that they're written, are actually formulated in such a way that they can easily be applied to the marginalized parts of society, that they are actually textbook ready to be put and used for dissidents, for people who are brown, people who are black, people who are immigrants, people who have funny-sounding names. This is what those sort of charges are good for, because when you put them in front of a jury, it's not that far that those jurors have to go to convince themselves that they're guilty, because they know as well as anybody in that room that the trial is not about whether they actually hurt any people, because they never did anything. The trial is about whether they intended to commit these acts. And if they can find somewhere in these words, this language, that they were in fact planning something, then they might themselves convince everyone in the jury that they should return a guilty verdict. I will add this little nugget detail that I didn't say, which is the undercover officers got a wire on May 4th, and it was through a court order. But there is a huge bulk of evidence that they're using against one person, Brian Jacob Church, from May 2nd, when they went to White Palace Grill on Roosevelt and Canal, and they did not have any sort of device. And they have each of these officers have now sat on the stand and described what Church was doing that day and how he told them, take the batteries out of the phone. Okay, so they took their batteries out of the phone. And then they said, okay, he said he's going to lead them to Chase Bank Tower. They went to Chase Bank Tower. Also, they're out-of-towners, and he seems to know pretty well where he's going, which is kind of absurd at some level. And so they went to the Chase Bank Tower, and then he said, he put his hand on the glass because he wanted to see how thick it was, and somehow that was going to be something that would give him information on how to damage the Chase Bank. They say that he ran, that Church ran up and down these stairs in the atrium by the Chase Bank Tower, was thinking about where he was going to have an entry point for an attack. Talked to them about attacking police stations, also mentioned shooting an arrow at Rahm Emanuel's house. This is all on what the officers are saying they heard, and you have absolutely no evidence that these this ever happened. And it is possible that these officers, what we don't know is we don't have the tone of their voice, and we don't have the way that these conversations played out. And we don't know how exactly Church got to the point where he was leading both of them to show where all these things were happening. So did they say something like, take us to where you're going to conduct this attack? Did these officers say, all right, what would you like to do? What do you imagine would be a sort of good thing to do in order to make your mark on the NATO protests? And maybe that was the catalyst that led Church to march them through the city to show what he could be, what he thought he'd be capable of doing, to count the surveillance cameras on the Chase Bank Tower and talk about how he would slip in unnoticed and do something. And how did you get to that is the big issue. It's like, how did you get that point where that conversation was happening?